Okay, it's a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Chaim Angel. I hope he got a little bit of sleep on the plane. He just landed an hour ago or so. And it's taken a while to get him here. He was originally scheduled to come last year, and then his wife had twins. He and his wife had twins. Baruch Hashem, they're doing well. So he's here this year. Rabbi Angel, of course, is the rabbi of Congregation Sheirit Yisrael, the Spanish Portuguese shul in New York. I think it was founded in 1700 or so, one of the oldest shuls in New York, a prestigious shul on the West Side. He succeeds his father, Rabbi Mark Angel, who was the rabbi there for many years, and he's continuing in that in the wonderful tradition. He teaches Bible at Yeshiva University. He has he's the author of three books on Parshanut. He has a master's from Azrieli, the School of Jewish Education, and it's a pleasure to have Rabbi Angel here to share his wide range of Torah knowledge with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you all for coming. I'm always inspired to come to a place where people are coming out on a Sunday morning to learn Tanakh. There's a great thirst for it all over the place, and this is my first time to Toronto, and what better way to, the first words I'm saying in Toronto are, hi, we're here to study Tanakh together. I teach at Yeshiva University, which has its own, you know, everybody in the department and everybody in the yeshiva has its own way of interpreting what Yeshiva University means. I can't really control the entire university as a part-time instructor, but at the very least, I could try to shape my own courses in terms of what my ideals are. After teaching there for 33 semesters, I've been trying to distill, if you had to talk about what it means yeshiva Tanakh learning and what it means academic Tanakh learning and what we have to do with one another, that's what this lecture essentially is the beginning of. So that's the goal. Broadly speaking, I'm talking about yeshiva just in terms of Orthodox Judaism and commitment, meaning that when we're learning Tanakh, we're studying it as the revealed word of God in one form or another. And that our conclusions of scholarship, when we're learning it, we're not just learning it to have a nice time, even though it's really fun, but we're doing it because by studying the Word of God, our religious worldview is changed. And that's ultimately what all form of yeshiva Tanakh learning must be. Academic learning, the fundamental underpinning of all academic learning is that you're not committed to any set of values or beliefs. Theoretically, if you teach in the academy, no matter what you personally believe, you're supposed to keep that in your head or in your heart, and you're supposed to approach the text from a so-called neutral perspective. And that's the goal of academic Bible scholarship. So in theory, the biggest yeshiva advocate and the biggest university advocate studying Tanakh could theoretically learn the same chapter in exactly the same way. Because after all, it's the same words, the same language, the same assumptions. You theoretically could come up with, go chapter by chapter, and two people with entirely different starting points, at least in theory, it's not likely, but at least in theory will come to the exact same conclusion. But what's the fundamental difference, even if they do, and even if they agree with exactly what this passage means? For the academic, that's where it officially stops. Because after all, the goal is the pursuit of truth. And once you have it, or at least, you think you have it, then you're done. Until somebody else can challenge that theory and come up with a better one. But at the very least, you're done with your pursuit. For the religious Jew, the same study is pursuit of truth for the sake of serving God. It's a means to an end. The reason why we learn is not just to know what it means, or what happened, or what the words indicate, or what the literary patterns are, or anything. We're studying all of this as the revealed word of God, and therefore it is a means to an end. So at least in some theoretical point of view, two people coming from these divergent vantage points could learn the text exactly the same way. It's just that our goals are different by definition. Now, one of the hot issues that has been hot forever and continues to be hot to the present day is, how should Orthodox Jews consider non-Orthodox scholarship? In the good old days, that meant Karaites and Christians, because that's what was out there. Today, there aren't a lot of Karaites. There are a few here and there, but I don't think that they comprise the majority of serious Bible study. There still are religious Christians of all denominations that pursue biblical study very seriously. And now there's a whole new crop of people, both Jewish and non-Jewish, who range from very committed conservative or reform or neutral or secular or atheist or agnostic. and still are really excellent scholars. So the question is, what do you do about that? And there's no clear answer in our tradition. What is clear is that many of our greatest interpreters saw great value in learning from anybody they can get their hands on. Some of the leading models of that in the medieval period were Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, who read everybody he can get his hands on and quotes more commentaries by name, Jewish, non-Jewish, than any other medieval Jewish commentary. He quotes about 40 different people, which in that era where you weren't required to have footnotes was a very big deal. Rambam, of course, his field was much more the merger of Judaism and philosophy, as he understood it, and as Aristotelian systems went back then, but that meant you knew Aristotle. Or at the very least, you knew the Muslim philosophers that translated Aristotle into Arabic, and that's what Rambam ultimately had at his disposal. Rabbi Isaac Abarbanel quoted Catholic theologians so much, there actually is a doctoral dissertation that was written back in the day by Chacham Solomon Gaon of London, talking about how much this fellow, Alphonse Tostado is his name, how much he influenced Abarbanel. And in fact, Abarbanel very often plagiarizes large chunks of Tostado's work without attribution. Now, for the record, back then that was far more respectable than it would be today. If you tried to plagiarize your commentary today and it was caught that you were doing verbatim, you'd get a very hard time, whether in a yeshiva or an academic setting. Back then, there was no stigma associated with it, and Abarbanel is free to admit that he was doing that sort of thing. And likewise, in the 19th century, many of our greatest rabbis, David Zvi Hoffman, Malbim in Germany, Rabbi Eliyahu ben Amozeg, and Shmuel David Luzzatto, and others in Italy, there were plenty of rabbis throughout the ages that benefited from non-Jewish or at least non-Orthodox scholarship, depending on the era. But that all being said, there were always, always opponents to this mode of thought, and for two different reasons. One was plain old ignorance, right? The assumption was, if it's not Orthodox Jews, they can't possibly know what they're talking about. So this is a purely ignorant point of view, because there are fine and excellent scholars of all different varieties. And so that point of view didn't really have much impact on those who were quoting non-Orthodox scholarship. But there's a better, more intelligent reason to oppose this type of inquiry. And that has to do with bias. We're all biased, everybody. There's no such thing as objective people. And since we're all biased, that means that whether we wish to admit it or not, we're bringing in our religious worldview or lack thereof. We're bringing in our cultural heritage. We're bringing in what our teachers taught us. We're bringing in our morality and values and all these. You cannot hide those things from your scholarship. You can try, and that's, I guess, one of the goals of scholarship is to try really hard, but there's simply always going to be a bias. And therefore, when you read non-Orthodox scholarship, even if it seems so convincing, and by the way, maybe it is, there's at least the possibility that it ceases to be pure scholarship and starts to be the bias of a given author, and that makes it, that's where foreign views come in. Of course, that was what Rambam got criticized for all the time, right? Here he is bringing in Aristotelian thought through Islamic translators, and at some point, is that really truth? Or at some point, is that the bias of whether the Greek philosophers or Islam or all the different things that were coming along? There's a wonderful story that you won't find in Art Scroll Gedolim stories, told by Rabbi Yosef Ibn Aknin, who lived in 13th century Spain, and like many others in Spain at that time, was a massive fan of Rambam. So he was one of these, you know, Torah and philosophy type of rabbis that you had in that era. And he wrote a gigantic commentary on the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. So I'm going to read the source in English, because I don't know the backgrounds of the people in this room, but you have the Hebrew if you wish to follow. Source number one. By the way, the reason why he's telling this particular Gedolim story is that he's going to be quoting non-Jewish writers in his own commentary. So he's trying to show that he's not inventing this method. So he says that there's a story that Rabbi Matzleach ben Albatzek, the rabbinic judge of Saklia, told Shmuel HaNagid, that when he came from Baghdad, which of course is one of the great centers of Jewish learning, that one day Rabbi Hai Gaon's yeshiva, they studied the verse, "Let my head not refuse such choice oil." Here they are studying a very difficult verse in the Book of Psalms, and by the way, as somebody who grew up in yeshiva where primarily Talmud was studied all day, I like the fact that here in the yeshiva they're sitting around studying a verse from Psalms and having a very engaged discussion about it. So Rabbi Hai Gaon was the leading rabbinic authority of that time. And those present debated its meaning. So here they are sitting around having a whole heated debate over what a particular verse in Psalms means. And they can't figure it out. So Rabbi Haigaon said, of blessed memory, told Rabbi Matzliach to go to the Catholic patriarch and ask him what he knew about this verse. It's like, you know, there's this great Catholic scholar down the block. He is an expert in Bible, and of course the Psalms in particular are beloved to Christians as well as to Jews. Go ask him. Maybe he has insight into this verse. And that will, I hope that didn't affect anything, but I'm going to keep going while you work that out. And this upset Rabbi Matzliach. In other words, even if Rabbi Matzliach didn't say anything, you could just see this horrified look of, what? I'm a Rosh Kollel from Baghdad. And I came to study Psalms with you, Rabbi Haigaon, the leading rabbi of our generation, and you're sending me off to the Catholic patriarch to learn what the verse is. So when Rabbi Hai saw that Rabbi Matzliach was upset, he rebuked him. Our saintly predecessors, who are our guides, solicited information on language and interpretation from many religious communities, even of shepherds, as is well known. Rabbi Haigaon doesn't get apologetic about this. From his point of view, Judaism means we're pursuing truth, and we're pursuing truth for the sake of heaven. And if truth might be with this Catholic patriarch down the block, we need to get that. We need to solicit his opinion. He didn't see this as a defensive thing, or he needed to get academic tenure, so he better quote the other guys. He really saw this as a necessary and central component of what it means to study Torah. It's an amazing story. And by the way, when I teach this story up at Yeshiva University, so my yeshiva guys for the most part have not necessarily even been exposed to this type of methodology. So it's a fun story to quote, I have to admit. But then I asked them to at least think about the other side of the equation. When Rashi's commentary came out, it became an instant international bestseller for Jews. It was immediately copied and took over the world. It's incredible just how, and to this day, of course, we marvel at Rashi's genius and the relevance of his commentary. Well, very soon thereafter, it was translated into Latin, and some Christian scholars began to study Rashi. And, not surprisingly, some other Christians said, how dare you quote a Jew? Here's an unsaved rabbi. You know where his soul is going to go. How can you possibly quote his scholarship? And so the scholars who did quote Rashi said, he's Rashi. He's incredible. And in fact, certain Christian commentators use Rashi so much that it's hard to find any original interpretation. It's kind of like just a Latin version of Perush Rashi that was introduced into the Christian world. Now, I admit, when I read that story, I beam with pride. I don't have any sympathy for the Catholics who opposed the introduction of Rashi. I immediately say, of course, they should accept Rashi, even though from their point of view, Rashi is damned. Why? Because Rashi was a phenomenal first-rate scholar far beyond what these individuals were producing, and as a result, they understood. Here's really excellent. On a personal note, I got a smile. I published an article on Sefer Yonah a few years ago, and just by accident, I stumbled across a website called Catholic Sensibility. And the reason why I stumbled upon it is because the fellow who was writing this blog was quoting this article that I had written. So here's a from Catholic, and he begins by saying, look, all my life I've quoted other Catholic writers, or at least Protestants. I've never quoted a Jew. But maybe, you know, maybe there's something we can learn from the Jewish world. And there's a link to a heter from the Pope on this website that it's okay to quote me. So I'm reading this just smiling and yes, it's very funny. But in the meantime, from his point of view, it's a very serious issue. How can he quote a Jew? And a rabbi, no less, quoting, talking about the book of Jonah, even though he likes the article. He really struggled. For him, this was a spiritual struggle. So I appreciate these struggles just because when Orthodox Jews go through these struggles the other way, it helps to understand that it's not a one-way street. Obviously, we're concerned much more about teaching Jews Judaism than about how Catholics should teach Catholics about Catholicism. That's their issue that they need to work through on their own. But from our point of view, it's a very serious issue. So to this day, it remains a hotly debated issue. I come out on the side of we start with the traditional sources, but we need to look beyond our traditional sources because there really are some excellent scholars. And then the issue is just the educational sensibility about what to do with that. Now, Rav Avraham Ben HaRambam actually stated this very, very strongly in his introduction to Agadah, in source number 2. One who wishes to uphold a known view and to elevate the one who said it and to accept his view without analysis and evaluation whether this view is true or not. In other words, if you're willing to accept an argument because of who said the argument as opposed to what the argument is and its merits, That is a bad trait. It is forbidden according to the Torah and according to logic. That's a very strong statement. He's saying you're not allowed to do that. And actually, you're violating Torah if you accept somebody's opinion because of who said it, as opposed to because of the merits of that particular argument after careful critical analysis. It is illogical. I like the way the line jumped right in the middle. That was a printing thing. That's really cool. But it actually is a perfect place in this passage to do it. For it indicates inadequate comprehension of what needs to be believed. I don't need to convince anybody here that accepting something on blind faith obviously is not you don't get a gold star in the logic department for that. But it's more curious that he says that it's prohibited according to the Torah. Why? It is forbidden according to the Torah, for it strays from the path of truth. You and I know that the whole reason why we learn Torah is that it is truth. This is God's seal. And the idea of making a conflict between commitment to Torah and intellectual honesty is a travesty. And that's what Rav Avraham ben Arambam is saying in very stark terms over here. That intellectual honesty must support Torah study. And in fact, if those two don't go together, you're violating not only logic, but you're violating the Torah itself. And then, of course, who are the best role models of all in terms of critical thinking? The sages do not accept or reject views except on the basis of their truth and proofs, not because the one who says them is who he is. Chazal accept nothing on face value. My favorite example of that is, and you'll have an earlier teaching saying, Masoret avotenu biyadenu. We have a received tradition. Okay, what's more indisputable than a received tradition in an oral law society? And what do? Almost 10 times out of 10, they'll challenge it. Well, what about this? Or this doesn't make sense. And they end up with a different conclusion. I love that. And so does Rav Avraham ben Arambam. In other words, Chazal realized if what's at stake is divine truth, we have to do our utmost to get there, to find every path available to be able to uncover truth. And so this is the positive side of the equation, one that I find very appealing on many levels. And obviously it has to be done with the proper reverence and commitment to finding divine truth. The best role model of that in the 20th century, there were several, was Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook, who said the only one we should ever fear is God. We shouldn't be afraid of ideas. And so putting his money where his mouth was, he had a student, Rabbi Moshe Seidel, and before Rav Kook died in 1935, told Rav Seidel, you know, there's all this academic critical scholarship out there that is inimical to Judaism, and it most certainly is. And some rabbis got into the trenches like Rav David Tzvi Hoffman and tried to fight the good fight. Rav Kook said, fine, we have to fight the good fight, but I'll bet you there's a lot of good teaching in all of that scholarship also. It's not all wrong. It's not all false. It's not all bad. I need a team of scholars who are going to go into those bunkers, not only to fight them, but who are going to try to understand what positive can we learn from that, and let's incorporate that into a traditional commentary. So in 1956, already 21 years after Rav Kook's passing, Rav Seidel had to teach some people in order to make this work. He taught a great, great, excellent group of students. In 1956, they sat down together and had their first meeting about, if we're going to write a world-class Orthodox commentary that incorporates all the findings of academic scholarship also, how are we going to do it? Well, it took him 7 years to work on that question. And in 1963, they began giving out assignments. Okay, you over there, Book of Judges. You over there, Book of Job. Somebody's not in the room. You get Chronicles. You know, like that. Whatever, whatever it's going to be. Whatever it's going to be. They distributed all the 24 books of Tanakh, and, you know, it was a work in progress. It took them 40 years until 2003 when Genesis Volume 3 was finally published. That was the last of this great series called Dat Mikra. It's a commentary that's published by, that's what the Dat Mikra series is. I never heard about it until I was in college, whereas it's the most relevant and contemporary Orthodox commentary that brings in everything. So when I teach in college, I'm like, guys, you got to get this stuff. Like, either if you can afford it, buy the whole schmear. It's expensive for a yeshiva college student. But if you can't, do, you know, as we're learning each sefer, buy that book and put it on your shelf. And next year you'll learn another book and buy that one. And over time you can accumulate the whole thing, or you'll get married and tell your father-in-law, this is what I want. You know, you find a way to make it work. You find a way to make it work. But this commentary is of exceptional value, and it actually achieves one of the goals that I believe a yeshiva and academy meeting is capable of accomplishing. Now let's think about the pros and cons of each system separate. On the yeshiva side of the coin, here's something that's good. We study it with passion. We're not, rather than studying it distanced, it's quite the opposite. We're learning this because this is the word of God. We love Torah. We're not studying it just as a nice intellectual pursuit. It's not the same thing as doing a crossword puzzle. Nothing against crossword puzzles. And that's where we're coming from. We also, by definition, give pride of place to traditional commentary. When you're learning in a yeshiva, Chazal and Rashi and Radak mean more than contemporary secular scholars or medieval or ancient non-Jewish scholars. They do, and they should. In other words, yeshiva study, by definition, is going to begin from the ground up with our canon of tradition and then draw later from the outside. Those are the positive sides of it, and ultimately it's very much like either you love your spouse or you love your children. Whatever love analogy you want to give, it's a very strong commitment, as anybody who studies Torah knows. The downside of yeshiva study, by definition, is you could very easily become incredibly chauvinistic. Incredibly. Where suddenly you think that either you or at least like-minded people have the entire monopoly on truth, where nobody else has anything relevant or intelligent to say. And that's something that's incredibly devastating to not only one's personality. Religion shouldn't make us snobbier, it should make us humbler. That's the goal of the Torah. So that's definitely a negative to all of this. It also compromises our ability to learn as scholars. Because what happens, and Megillat Esther, it's coming up soon, it's the best example of them all. If you learned it when you were 4, it's really, really hard to learn it when you're 20 or 40 or 80 because you're still thinking about what you learned when you were 4. It's really, really hard to reevaluate evidence, no matter how serious you are, because we all have our education. And whereas on the one hand, education is a good thing. We spend lots of money on day school tuitions for this. On the other hand, it really comes with a crippling effect of biasing students when they get older, in unable to be able to reevaluate the evidence. And that's a serious pro and a con. I wouldn't trade the issue of education for neutrality. But on the other hand, that by definition comes with a certain negativity. So that's where academic Bible scholarship actually can gain by not having all of the weight of day school education. Nothing against it. It's great. But childhood education even. Somebody can come, when I teach adult education, I'm teaching people who have been learning all of their life. I'm teaching people who can't tell an aleph from a bet and everything in between. And I find that beautiful because what happens is we sit over a text. And some people might have a knee-jerk reaction to say what they learned when they were 5. And somebody who's 40 and never opened it before said, where do you see that? And all of a sudden, the person who's been learning it all his life or all her life looks down and says, you know, it's not there. And I'm like, you see? This sort of dialogue I find incredibly healthy. The downside of the academy, it's getting better on some fronts, but it still has a long ways to go, is that the academy pretends to be neutral, but it's not because it can't be. Nobody is unbiased. And when you hear about commentaries that are written called scientific commentaries, I just roll my eyes, even if it's a great commentary. It's just not science. You cannot prove objectively any particular reading, because you know what? If you can, Rashi would have already done that, and we would have been done. The reason why new commentaries continue to be written and why people can come up and share new ideas all the time is precisely because the Torah is infinite and not a science. Yes, there are certain standards to being faithful to the text, but that is wildly different from saying you now have objectively, conclusively proven something. The grand example of that is the so-called documentary hypothesis, if you're familiar with it, which continues to be taught in universities around the globe. Julius Wellhausen, who was a great German liberal Protestant scholar in the late 19th century, his name is most often linked to it, even though there were other players involved, both before and after him, who refined it. His view was that the Torah is comprised primarily of 4 different documents, hence documentary, and it's a hypothesis in the sense that it is not and cannot and never will be proven, but amazingly enough, it's still treated by many as science, and that's the word hypothesis has fallen out of the discussion, even though that's what it's called. And it was comprised over many centuries, none of which go back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Like the earliest layers are maybe the time of Shlomo HaMelech, and then, you know, different layers down the line through the time of Ezra and maybe a little bit beyond that. And when he dated the so-called documents the way that he did, liberal Protestants ate it right on up. At the beginning, Jews opposed it vigorously. Solomon Schechter called it higher criticism. He referred to this as the higher anti-Semitism because he realized that there was something very strongly anti-Jewish, and he was right. And the reason why it was so anti-Jewish, even though Wellhausen pretended to be an objective scholar, it goes like this. Which documents did he date oldest? Stories about Abraham Avinu, they're very old. Then came the prophets, like Isaiah, Amos. And then came the laws. The laws are the last part. First Deuteronomy, and then the so-called priestly laws with the sacrifices, which Wellhausen really hated. So what is he trying to say in this neutral, objective, scholarly way? He's saying the real religion of Israel is the religion of the patriarchs, which has no laws, and the religion of the prophets, who really don't talk a lot about the laws. That's the real religion of Israel, which, of course, funny enough, became Christianity. Aha. Now, the laws were written by these priests and sages much, much later on. They're a corruption of the true religion. Now, he didn't say it quite like that because he was professing neutrality in academia. And, of course, many people bought into this. John Levinson of Harvard University published a book in 1993 just exposing the magnitude of how strongly Christian this hypothesis is and how anti-Jewish and Judaism this hypothesis is. Now, that all being said, so that's what's called neutrality. Yeah, right. Massive bias, funny enough. But he didn't claim it that way. And that's one of the major hazards of the academy, is the pretense of scientific neutrality when there cannot be such a thing, right? Now, to be fair, that doesn't mean that every single point that he made is invalid. There are many excellent questions. Chazal and our Rishonim thought of them too, incidentally, many of them. There are many valid conclusions and findings within all of that. And in fact, the original hypothesis has been modified time and again, and many elements of it are extremely valuable to our learning. I don't think that it's all pasul. But that all being said, the fundamental impetus wasn't just scholarship. And nobody is coming in with all scholarship. For an excellent example today, okay? Year 2012, at least as of last check a couple of years ago, Western Europe, okay, democracies, liberal, open to everybody, right? There is not one single Jewish professor of Bible in all of Western Europe today. Not 1884, right, when this was all going down. Zero. Now, that goes without saying, many of them are church appointees. There are Jewish professors in Western Europe, but not of Bible. Well, guess what that means, folks? That means that there's no Jewish voice presenting another side to the equation. That means that not all Christian scholars have an anti-Israel bias, but a whole bunch of them sure do. And what they're doing by imposing these so-called minimalist views, which are popular in certain circles in Western Europe, they're making the argument that there was no biblical Israel the way that the Bible presents it. This is far more dangerous than Holocaust denial, because it's undermining the very roots of our claim to the land of Israel. So if you think that this is a perfectly neutral scholarly endeavor, you're crazy. It's a very politicized type of endeavor and one that's insanely dangerous to the people of Israel, both in the land of Israel, but worldwide. And the fact that there's not a single Jewish professor of Bible in Europe able to get up there at a conference and counter it obviously continues to grow that bias in a direction that I find very, very, very scary. So this all being said, as religious Jews, our job is to admit our biases. Yes, we do favor Orthodox Jewish scholarship to all other, at least as a matter of starting point, and that's a bias. I like this bias, but that's still a bias. It does change our ability to weigh everything neutrally. One of the best advocates of this method is that of Ramban. Ramban wrote a work called Milchamot Hashem. It's a commentary on the entire Talmud. If you name your book Milchamot Hashem, Wars of the Lord, somebody's in trouble, because you're fighting a war against somebody. In this case, the poor victim of Ramban is Rabbi Zrachya Halevi, who wrote a sefer called Hamaor HaGadol, and we refer to him in yeshiva circles as the Baal Hamaor. He lived in the century before him in Provence. So Ramban writes an introduction to this Wars of the Lord, where his major goal is to write a Shas-wide commentary. He's not just attacking the Baal Hamaor, but the Baal Hamaor is going to pay a heavy price for criticizing the Rif, who was his predecessor, and that's the three-way cycle over there. So Ramban says, anyone who studies our Talmud, source number 3 on the next page here, knows that the arguments between its interpreters do not have absolute proofs. It is not like mathematics. Ramban understood only too well. There's no such thing as a scientific commentary on Torah. Rather, we must exert all of our efforts in every debate to push aside one of the views with compelling logical arguments and consider most likely the view that fits the smooth reading of the text and its parallels along with good logic. This is the best we can do, and the intent of every wise and God-fearing person studying the wisdom of the Talmud, and the same thing applies, of course, to Tanakh. So this all being said, what do we have going for us so far? There is value, and in fact a lot of value, to admitting into the discussion non-Orthodox scholarship, even though Orthodox scholarship certainly dominates within a yeshiva premise learning. That all, and there's no science to this. To say that we are objective is crazy. To say that academics are objective is also crazy. Nobody's objective, and the best we can hope to do is work faithfully within our tradition and then to be able to benefit from the world that is out there. Now, the ideal synthesis, therefore, it's kind of hard to do this, and I struggle with this on a daily basis, and anybody I think engaged in this has to struggle with it. The goal of learning Tanakh is to get ever closer to God and to become a better person. These are twin goals that must be at the center of why we're learning Tanakh, or what are we doing? We're certainly not in this for the money. It's like, you know, it's very clear that these are very strong twin goals, and then ultimately to take that inspiration and build a better community and society. That's the vision of Tanakh, and that's why we learn it. So that's part one, that's the commitment side, and part two is being able to take several steps back, because that's what analysis does. Analysis means being able to distance yourself from the material and consider, is the way that I learned it today really right? Maybe there's a way I should be learning it starting tomorrow that's different. And that requires taking several steps back from your commitment to what you thought the text meant, being able to really consider different points of view and consider them fairly rather than just sweeping them away. Oh, that's not what I thought. Right? Okay, so that's not what you thought. Why bother learning today? So you already know what you think. But if you're actually interested in a constant learning process throughout a lifetime, as you by definition are for being here, in other words, that's what I find so inspiring about adults that continue to learn, because you actually have a better opportunity to process sophisticated arguments and take Tanakh learning or Gemara learning, whatever you're doing, to a much, much higher level than we could have possibly done when we were in school back in the day. That's the goal of all of this. The Talmud Yerushalmi actually has a wonderful expression for all of this that my father likes to quote in his writings, and I just think it's great for this particular discussion. The path of the Torah is fire to its right and ice to its left. One who veers in one direction dies in the fire. If you're too intensely passionate, you get fried because there's no way to be able to learn properly. One who veers the other way dies from the ice. If you become too cold and sterile and it becomes an intellectualized pursuit, well, then you freeze. It stops being the passionate, fiery Tanakh that we're supposed to be learning and it starts becoming an intellectual exercise. What should he do? He should walk in the middle. Okay, sure, easier said than done. Middle is always that coveted place, and middle is a really hard place to really find. But ultimately, that's what I find my entire goal in learning to be able to do, where there's constant commitment and at the same time there's constant analysis and reevaluation of what I thought I was committed to. And that's very, very, it's a tough juggling act, but one that I find incredibly stimulating and beneficial in many ways, and one that I try, of course, to teach my students in all settings wherever I go. That also means that we're living at a really good time for all of this, because from the 19th century, the playing field really did change as a result of archaeological findings, as a result of the flourishing of academic Bible study, which suddenly means that linguistics and archaeology and ancient literary texts that we have and ancient Near Eastern analogs for everything from priestly clothing, you know, all the stuff that we're reading about now, temple building, it is incredibly edifying to see that we didn't make up a lot of stuff, but we transformed a lot of stuff. There's no question that the comparative literature study between the Torah and the legal codes and the social codes and all the different ritualistic elements, what came before the Torah was given to Bnei Israel, we gain so, so, so much from being able to realize what the Torah is doing in its context and what the Torah is trying to break away from. And certain scholars in Israel realized the magnitude of how good this was, including Umberto Casuto, Yehuda Elitzur, Yoshua Meir Grintz, and Yechezkel Kaufman, all of blessed memory, who just got right on into the trenches and realized, here's an opportunity to appreciate Israel, not in the vacuum. When I learned it in school, that is, God revealed the Torah in Sinai, and it's as though there were no other people anywhere. We know that they're the Mitzrim, because they were bad. But we don't think about what was their culture, and what was their religious society, and what were their beliefs. And what did Bnei Israel know from within Egypt? Well, it sure helps to know that stuff. And for the first time, starting in the 19th century, we actually can know that stuff. A very little one that the Netziv was very excited about was just Moshe's name. Rabbi Silber mentioned before the naming of Moshe with you know, Pharaoh's daughter named Moshe. And named that king Minamayim Mishitihu, because I drew him out of the water. So our medieval grammarians puzzled, well, it should have been Mashui. It's, you know, one of these technical grammatical questions that kind of is interesting, but they always say, don't worry, biblical names are close to the etymology, they don't always have to be the same. If you wanted to be more literary about it, you can say, Well, Moshe actually covers a double meaning. He himself was drawn out of the water, but not that long from now, he will be Moshe B'nai Israel. He will draw B'nai Israel through Yam Suf. So it actually has this great double meaning, and that's a great literary understanding of his name. But Chazal already asked, you know, Pharaoh's daughter, she was very compassionate, but how in the world did she know Hebrew so well to make such a nice etymology? So the Gemara in Sota answers the way that the Gemara would answer this sort of question, which is she must have gone to a conversion course and she took the introductory Hebrew, and she knew Hebrew well because she was Jewish, which is great. But obviously a Pashtan is going to struggle with, is that really what's going on here? I love it. For all kinds of reasons, we'll talk about that another occasion. But for our purposes here, so what's going on? Abarbanel was so bothered by this problem, he said, actually, when it says that she named him, since Moshe's mother is somewhere in this puzzle as the one who's nursing, she refers all the way back to Moshe's mother, which at least solves the Hebrew problem. Grammatically, this is a disaster. And Abarbanel knows that it's a disaster, but he realizes, how could Pharaoh's daughter have come up with such a nice, subtle wordplay? In the 19th century, we finally learned from Egyptian documents that Moshe means in Egyptian, son, S-O-N. And plenty of pharaohs thought Moshe, there are plenty of pharaohs that have the name Moshe in their name. And it doesn't mean anything, it's like Johnson, right? So it's son of whatever. So what happened was, very simply, Pharaoh's daughter named Moshe Moshe, meaning my son, and the Torah is actually making what you and I would call a midrash. It's darshaning the name into its Hebrew meaning, because obviously for us, it's nice that the Egyptian means S-O-N, son, but what we care about is that he was drawn from the water and that he will subsequently draw B'nai Israel from the water. This is fantastic. So then Nitziv, when he heard about this, he writes in his commentary, this is great. I heard from a friend that we found Egyptian documents that Moshe's son in Egyptian, that's it. That's Pshuto Shel Mikra. We don't have to start breaking our teeth anymore about how Pharaoh's daughter knew Hebrew. She didn't. She named him a good Egyptian name. And that the Torah transforms it into its Hebrew meaning. That's just a tiny example of zillions that one could give. And that's certainly very, very, very helpful. That all being said, we can't solve all problems with this. And it's important to recognize our limitations from all of that. Yeah. So this all points to a broader issue. The important thing from my point of view is, and this is what I teach my students all the time, is that our grounding needs to be in traditional sources, in the text itself, in Midrash, in our Mefarshim, and then to look outward afterwards. And the reason why I'm so big on that is the same reason why I would tell a student going to college, if you want to take a comparative religion course, you appreciate it more if you actually know your own religion. Especially because when you hear two lectures on Judaism, you realize Judaism is a little more complex, and that'll help you appreciate that when you hear two lessons on Christianity, maybe Christianity is a little more sophisticated than what a professor can possibly cover in two lectures, and maybe Islam or Buddhism. It helps you respect other people more, actually, when you understand your own religion more. If you don't understand any religion, and then you come in and hear this comparative religion course, you think, oh, I now know all 10 different religions in just a 15-week semester. I'm an expert, right? But of course, when you understand how long it takes to master Judaism, it's a lifelong process and you still don't master it, well, then you start to be able to appreciate other people a whole lot more. And so I find that the more you're committed from within, the more you're able to appreciate what other people are trying to do and what their own methodologies are. Another value to me in studying non-Orthodox scholarship very simply is, let's say all the Orthodox scholars, ha, 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 agree. Yeah, right. But let's say they all did. But let's say some non-Orthodox scholars come up with a totally different reading of the text. That forces me to at least say, are we all looking at through Orthodox colored glasses, but it's not actually in the text? Or are we right? But this forces the question. In other words, because we're all coming at it from certain assumptions and beliefs, sometimes we might lose sight of the fact that some of our beliefs cross the boundary for what's really in the text and what is not. So if somebody who believes something completely different from what we do thinks the same thing, that actually encourages us to believe, okay, we're all looking at the same text, we're able to read it as one. And if we disagree, well, let's at least ask the question, are we reading it right? Or maybe this is a challenge that we need to help reevaluate the text. The Moshe thing, again, is an excellent example, where until the 19th century, this theory simply was not available to traditional or non-traditional commentaries because we did not have the relevant information. On the flip side of the equation, the academy can get a good, healthy dose of what it's learning from people who are the heirs to what the Tanakh is trying to teach. Those of us who are believing Jews are actually the living heirs to what the Nevi'im wanted to achieve, to the best possible, and we try our best. But at least in theory, we're accepting that the prophets really are prophets, and we're accepting that we want to live our lives in accordance with their vision. I'm actually encouraged that there are non-Orthodox scholars of all different stripes who are realizing the values of just learning Rashi and Ibn Ezra now. That wasn't true 100 years ago when scholarship condescendingly referred to the medieval commentators as pre-critical. Ugh, these dogmatic heads in the sand rabbis or priests or ministers. They didn't know what they were talking about. Only we from the 19th century on have anything relevant to say. That's not true anymore. There's one scholar in California, his name is William Propp. He writes in his appendix that he's an atheist, right? In this commentary called the Anchor Bible, which is ostensibly a secular commentary that spans different faith communities or non-faith communities. He wrote like a 2,000-page commentary on the Book of Shemot. I like this. Here's an atheist who's committed his entire life to studying Torah. I think that's really cool, and it obviously is a tribute to the Torah and its drawing power. It's not just drawing the committed. It's drawing somebody who claims that not only does he not believe in Torah min ha-shamayim, he doesn't believe in the Shamayim part, right? Right? It's amazing. And what does he write in his appendix besides professing his own atheistic beliefs? He says his favorite people to read are the Rishonim. He doesn't call them that. He calls them, you know, the medieval rabbis. Why? Because we scholars are so busy carving up the Torah into this and that atomic, atomistic reading, we lose sight of what the big picture is. Whereas those rabbis who viewed the Torah as a unified whole were able to look at the Torah and say, we see this as a unified, coherent whole. And he says maybe at the end of the day, we academics should realize that the Torah is a coherent whole. He doesn't come to that conclusion the same way that I would, but at least he realizes that the Rishonim were onto something very powerful that the academic world completely missed. But here's the good news. In the 1970s, a lot of these things changed. We had a battleground going on for a very long time. In the 1970s, we had something called the good old literary revolution in biblical scholarship, where for the first time, academics were saying, you know what? We've been mulling for the last 100, 200 years. How did the Bible get here? Let's stop asking that question for a minute, since these debates get really passionate and we can't prove anything anyway. Let's just say this. We can all agree on one thing. Now the Bible's here. So what does it mean? Well, that's a very different question from how did it get here. Right? The academics for a long time were just obsessing over how it got here and what centuries and what datings and this and that and the other thing. Nobody was paying attention, or at least not enough attention to, well, therefore, what does it mean? Let's look at the final product. So a believing Jew would say God revealed the Torah, and a non-believing something would say that it was composed over many centuries. Okay, we disagree. But now we can all agree, let's study Shemot Perek Kaftet. And let's break our heads and let's try to figure out what this text means. And this is what Professors Nechama Leibowitz and Mordechai Breuer, each in his or her own way, the two great Orthodox scholars of the previous generation, this is what they were trying to do. They were trying to show that no matter how you get there, there's so much meaning and so much depth, we need to be able to access that. And in the current generation, we have Rabbi David Silber here, who's one of the pioneers of this sort of methodology within the Orthodox world. We also have people like Rav Yoel Ben Nun, Shalom Karmi at Yeshiva University, and Elchanan Samet in Israel. These are people who are producing creative scholarship written from an Orthodox point of view that take all the details into account, that look at literary trends, that follow the linguistics, that pay attention to all of the different wordplays, and clearly bring in much that the non-Orthodox world of scholarship has to offer. It's very clear. And I think that people like this are treasures. They really are bringing the best of Tanakh out to the present day generation. And there's a thirst for this type of learning. There's, you know, thank God there's a growing trend as usual, and I'm happy to say this. Israel is way ahead of the curve. They're a generation ahead of us here in America, where there's just a few people who are teaching at this type of high level. Most of the action is still over there. And I'm happy to know that Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, that we've reached an age where the prominent centers of Torah are, in fact, in Israel. That all being said, the rest of us are not off the hook. We have to do the best that we can. And I think that this ultimately is the path that's going to prevail for a very long time to come within Tanakh learning circles, where people realize that Orthodox scholarship has a tremendous amount of relevance and contemporary use, and at the same time that there's much to be gained from non-Orthodox scholarship too. Ultimately, by recognizing the strengths and weaknesses of what the yeshiva learning and what academic learning are and what they have to offer, I think that ultimately we can create a dialogue that spans all belief divides and all personal bias divides, because ultimately we can all come down and study the most important book that's ever been written in the world, history, which is, of course, Tanakh. In the early morning liturgy, we say, at least in my liturgy, we say, that you should be as God-fearing in in private as you are in public. And v'dover amet v'bilvavo, that you should be able to speak truth in your heart, right? That's ultimately the goal, this bridging of God-fearingness and intellectual honesty, which are the greatest of our rabbinic teachers have always taught us, really are the ultimate key to how we're going to propel ourselves into the 21st century, inspired, committed, with both eyes open intellectually and being able to engage in dialogue with people far beyond our immediate circles. That's what I had to say as an outline on the subject. Thank you so much. And until Rabbi Kelman tells me that I have to start the Sforno Shiur, I'm happy to entertain questions on this one.
Doesn't the Gemara say Chachum Bagoyim Tamin Torah Bagoyim Al Tamin?
It does. And that all being said, our Mefarshim have always learned Torah from the Goyim.
But it says Torah Bagoyim Al Tamin.
I understand that. And that all being said, Rav Haigaon said.
How do you reconcile that?
I don't reconcile it. I think that there are different points of view within our tradition. In fact, Rav Matzliach would quote that Gemara against Rav Haigaon. He was upset, right? So my point in bringing that story is that this has always been a debate. That Gemara reflects one side of the equation, and there's another strong rabbinic tradition that reflects the other side of the equation. So rather than trying to reconcile people that are clearly arguing, they're arguing. Okay. So I agree that there certainly are dissenting points of view, as I mentioned in the Shiur.
Can I ask one quick question? Is there a comprehensive defense against Bible criticism from the Orthodox viewpoint?
Nobody's refuted the entire Shmir, if that's what you're asking. The heroes in this battle in the 19th century were Rav David Zvi Hoffman, really went into the trenches and did his absolute best. In the 20th century, you had two people who I wouldn't call Orthodox, but at least were committed to dissecting and refuting the documentary hypothesis. One was Umberto Casuto, who grew up in Florence and then taught at the Hebrew University. He gave a series of lectures trying to undermine the entire documentary hypothesis. And then you had somebody, a Reform rabbi named Benno Jacob, who Nachama Leibowitz likes very much for this reason. So while Benno Jacob was anti-observance, and therefore I have an issue with that, obviously, he felt that the documentary hypothesis was primarily anti-Judaism, and he took umbrage at that and tried hard to refute it. So there are two books that just came out fairly recently, if you want a summary of all this. There's somebody, Richard Elliot Friedman, who's in California also, who wrote a book called Who Wrote the Bible, where he tries to give a very cogent, readable, popularized version of the documentary hypothesis with his personal spin on it. And then there were some, I don't remember who wrote the counterclaim, but there's a picture of a dog on the cover. It's like, who really wrote the Bible? Which is a gotcha, you know, type of, it's a strong rebuttal of a lot of the common arguments, specifically written to reject Friedman's book. So I recommend both. And so I'm closer to the second one than to the first one. Well, I think we need to go to the mic. So somebody was waiting over there. You may want to line up behind. Yeah.
Where do you put James Kugel in this picture?
Kugel's an interesting person. He's a friend of mine. I plan on giving a shiur on him in 2 weeks, actually, at my synagogue. For the short form of the answer, there are certain things that I think he makes very good points. His fundamental flaw, if I may say so, is that he believes that traditional scholarship and academic scholarship are utterly irreconcilable. That's his hypothesis in a 748-page book, with the references on the website because there wasn't enough room to publish it in the book type of thing. It's a gigantic book. I read the whole thing as soon as it came out and gave a review shiur on it immediately, A, because Jim Kugel grew up in my community, actually. I mean, he's much older than I am, but he graduated our Hebrew school, and he's a longtime friend. Whenever I go to Israel, we sit down over hummus and tea and talk Tanakh because I like people that I can talk Tanakh with. But I thoroughly disagree with his conclusion that tradition and Bible scholarship are utterly reconcilable. I think the way he casts tradition and the way he casts biblical scholarship are irreconcilable, but I don't think the world is the way he describes it.
Which part?
Both. I think he oversimplifies both, not just because how much do you want to get in when you already have used up 748 pages, but I think fundamentally he's operating from the pre-literary revolution stage where they really were much more at loggerheads than we would be today with the academy. So that, and again, it's obviously that's an al regal achat. Huh?
Even the academy.
Yeah, but he's a traditionalist. He doesn't fully accept traditional belief, and that's one of the things that he struggles with in his book. But at the same time, he shomer Shabbat and Kashrut. I could eat his hummus, you know. I'm not walking into an atheist's home. I'm walking into a very committed Jew who really thinks seriously about these issues, something I admire about him quite a lot. But that all being said, I disagree fundamentally with his conclusion, and I disagree very strongly with it. Okay, that all being said, okay, let's give somebody else a...
Who was that?
His name is Jim Kugel. He taught at Harvard for many years. Yeah. He taught in Harvard for many years. Yeah, and now he's in Bar-Ilan.
Any other questions? One last question?
Thank you.
If I may, sir, if you can answer for half a minute. Have you had this type of discussion with anybody in the yeshiva world who obviously gives a different approach to this?
The answer is sure. Yeah, the answer is I'm able to talk to people across the Orthodox spectrum exactly because I believe in what the whole Orthodox spectrum believes in. And I think that makes it easier to have this type of conversation. So yeah, I've had plenty of conversations. That's the 30-second answer. The only way I'd be able to answer that question fully is if I gave this shiur to all of them and then hear their reaction. I don't know if that's true, and I certainly have very good relationships with many of them, and we talk Tanakh all the time, so I feel that you're over-stereotyping the situation. There are certain back-and-forths and hazards. There are certain back-and-forths and hazards that I spoke about in the shiur where the Orthodox world will find room for divide and debate, but not one that's fundamental, and that's, I think, the issue.
Okay, thank you very much.